This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, I'm Evan Wasuka, and welcome to Pacific Review from ABC Radio Australia, where we'll be taking a look at the big stories from across the region over the past week. Coming up, prominent Pacific politician Hilda Heine is back as the president of Marshall Islands, while another Pacific leader, Manasseh Sogavare, has been named Pacific Person of the Year, and low-lying coral atolls are often seen as doomed in the face of climate change, but a group of scientists say that's not the case at all. We'll have more on those stories coming up. In a surprise political development, prominent Pacific politician Hilda Heine was voted back in as the president of Marshall Islands this week. She last held the post from 2016 to 2020, where she used her platform to raise global awareness on climate change. Her vote back into office, says the editor of the Marshall Islands Journal, Gift Johnson, came by way of a dramatic tiebreaker in Parliament.
Well, every 4 years we have a big drama at the Parliament, the nitty-jelly here, and the place was packed, standing room only. People were there over an hour before they even started the ceremony. And yes, it was the newly elected nitty-jelly, which features 13 new faces, which is 40% turnover in this most recent election. So people were sworn in and the vote commenced. The speaker and vice speaker votes both rolled out first with 18 to 15 margins for now President Heine's team. So the indication was that she was going to get the win in the president vote. But when it came time to do the vote, the way it was counted, it's a secret ballot on little bits of paper. It was like a basketball game, and it just went one vote back and forth all the way up to 16-16, and they were tied. And it was, you know, 500 people holding their breath for the last ballot to be counted, and it was announced, and it was Hilda. So she wins with a razor slim majority. I mean, the absolute minimum, 17 to 16, but she's in, and she'll be formally sworn in later this morning to begin assuming her position as president for the second time.
Now, Gif, what's the public reaction like to Hilda Heine coming back as president?
My feeling is, in particularly in Majuro, the capital, people are very supportive. I think there's also, in Marshallese society, culturally, there's a norm of women handing off their, you know, like the spokesman's job to the male in the family, like by tradition. So there's, you know, those older people have a hard time seeing a woman in the top job like this. But I think for for younger Marshallese, and particularly people in the capital, I think they're quite happy about the result, and we'll see how it plays out. But she already had a term in which, you know, she initiated a whole range of programs and projects, and which continued through this just finished administration of President David Kabua, and I'm sure she's going to dive back in much the same way that she was in her first administration.
Now, we had the election results come out almost a month ago. Was it a surprise that Hilda Heine would be the candidate for president for the opposition grouping, so to speak?
You know, it's really hard to predict elections here because there are no political parties, and generally all the election voting is based on family, relatives, friends like that. So, you know, it's difficult to predict the outcome. And there was really only one electorate where a political issue seemed to be the driving issue behind the incumbents losing. But key incumbents of the now outgoing administration of David Kabua lost their reelection bids, and that really put now President Hilda in a commanding position. And on paper, from that election, November 20, she had a majority. But it was one of those things where they had to organize it and pull people in, because it's not a party, right? So it's a lot of different groups and factions, and generally maybe aligned with her thinking, but one of those things where it had to be managed to come to an outcome yesterday with that 17-16 vote.
That was Giff Johnson, the editor of the Marshall Islands Journal. Debate is raging in Fiji over plans to build a $2 billion casino and hotel with up to 1,000 rooms in the tourism hub of Nandi. Head of the project, Sandeep Singh, says it will help boost the tourism and real estate sectors in Fiji. But Mr. Singh has also said Fijian citizens won't be allowed onto the premises, and that sparked outcry from some citizens.
I know, according to I read in the news in the morning, that the indigenous people are not allowed to take part in the, are not allowed to enter the area or the casino itself. And the question is, who are they going to employ? Are they going to bring their own people to Fiji? And this another problem there, I know.
My name is Roger Kroka, and I am from the Suva area, but I'm originally from Rotuma. I think the casino scenario that we're going through right now in Fiji should be approached very carefully, because although it has a lot of employment opportunities for the youths of our country, but at the same time there are concerns with the increase in criminal activity that could be generated through the casinos, money laundering, prostitution, increase in drugs, the selling of drugs, and all sort of new forms of criminal activity that could enter Fiji that we're not prepared to face, because we're such a small island country.
Hi, I'm Niraj Mudaliar, a former Fijian diplomat and civil servant who currently resides in New Zealand. I totally think it's discriminatory. If you look at from the human rights perspective, that's very discriminatory of you allowing certain people to play casino, and you will not be allowed to play casino if you are Fiji national and if the casino is based within Fiji. So I believe that's discriminatory in nature, and I don't think so that, it's a blanket no should be applied to all Fiji citizens, that they cannot gamble and be reasonable about it. Because I have a lot of friends who are in Fiji, friends and families, and when they come to New Zealand, they do go to casinos and do gamble, but they're very reasonable with it. They know their limits. If they win, then they enjoy the money that they have, or if they lose, that it doesn't affect them, because they enjoy that space reasonably.
Those were the voices of some Fijian citizens airing their views about the proposed casino project. Nalini Singh is the former chair of the NGO Coalition on Human Rights in Fiji, and she told me that the human rights question was just one of the many questions that developers will have to resolve before the project can progress.
There's a whole range of issues that come into play in the sense that, who is where is the regulatory body for such a institution, and who puts in the frameworks for who gets to enjoy those facilities and not. The developer coming in and outrightly saying that the locals won't be allowed, is that what the frameworks are going to be aligned with? There are many more questions that need to be answered before, we look at the eventual, construction of such a facility or not. There's a lot of issues in the range of the people of Fiji, are we fully aware of what such type of development actually means for a small country like ours? Where are some examples where small countries like ours who have set up casinos, and what have been the benefits and the implications? Have we looked at who actually are the developers, and where are the money to develop such a facility coming from? Someone earlier on had said that we have to be very, very sure that none of such type of constructs leads on to further criminal activities. So we have to be very, very careful about all this. So for me, going into the question of who is going to be allowed in, that is one important question. But there are so many other questions that need to be answered before we even get there, in the sense that, are we actually aware of what such type of development means? Are the landowners part of such discussions in terms of what their contributions are going to be? And who actually is going to own it? And where is the money coming from? Because at the bedrock of all of this, and the type of activity and the foundations of this will depend on all of those, Evan.
Yes, there's certainly lots of different layers and lots of different threads to go through there. But in theory, coming from a human rights lens, is it discriminatory to allow only certain people to enter these facilities?
Look, it all depends on the different types of models that we have for such businesses. For me, to decide on who is going to be allowed in and who's not going to be allowed in depends on very clearly an open discussion and understanding by people to make sure that, we are aware of that we are not making, a bad situation already from the beginning worse. Yes, we are reliant on the tourism industry in a very significant way for our economy, and we should be looking at different opportunities to generate the income. But having a casino means that, yes, there is potential for a lot of local people to be employed. So definitely, the restrictions around who is going to get employed in such a facility, has to be, open to us. Who gets to play the different, games and all the different paraphernalia that casinos have? That, to me, we cannot have restrictions, blindly put in restrictions to say that, locals will not be allowed.
Nalini Singh is the former chair of the NGO Coalition on Human Rights in Fiji. It's the holiday season, but in Samoa, expensive airfares and few flight options are causing headaches. Now, citizens and tourism operators are urging the government for immediate action to purchase a new aircraft to meet the growing travel demands. The ABC's Samoa reporter, Adil Fruin, filed this report from the capital, Apia.
It's been 4 years now Samoa last hired an aircraft. Since Samoa opened its borders last year, a significant number of tourists have visited the island. Although tourism operators and businesses say that's good news, the calls for the nation to re-establish its own airline have intensified.
It's not a new issue, and it's a question that has been asked so many times now. And ever since the new government came into power about, 2.5-3 years ago.
That was HRPP party deputy leader Lawofo Pia Funtoe. When it was in power, the HRPP signed the lease for new Boeing 737 for Samoa Airlines. But when Samoa's new government took power in 2021, it ended the lease on the new aircraft, citing high ongoing maintenance costs for the loss-making airline as COVID travel restrictions hit hard. The decision costs the government 16 million Samoan Tala, or 9 million Australian dollars. Since the borders reopened, the HRPP and tourism operators have been calling for the government to source a new aircraft.
Every time we meet to debate the budget or their budget, we have been bellowing from our side in the chamber the need for an aircraft for Samoa, as we used to have. 3 years ago, I remember when the new government or the current government presented their budget, there were many members on our side who were expressing strong views against the new government or the present government returning the aircraft that we engaged and signed an agreement for operating in Samoa. And at the time, the aircraft, I think it was a 737-800 aircraft, it was sitting on the tarmac in Brisbane, at Brisbane Airport, ready or being prepared for its final certifications before it was to be flown over to Samoa to commence its operations here under the flag of Samoa Air. That didn't eventuate, as obviously.
The opposition party's deputy leader says that now Samoa is slowly returning to normality. There is a high demand not just for tourists, but for locals to travel.
Now we're seeing the consequences of not having an aircraft. As you can see, well, as you know, between Apia and Auckland, there's only one airline operating that route, and that is Air New Zealand, of course. And it's basically a monopoly of this particular route.
According to La Wofo, there should be competition for high traffic routes such as Apia to Auckland. He added that there are options for flights between Samoa and Australia, which is a relief. Samoa's government did not answer specific questions from the ABC, but in recent media reports, the government's finance minister says it will consider leasing a new aircraft down the line. Local tourism operators have also been vocal in the push.
I think Air New Zealand's really milking Samoa for all it's worth. And it's something that's really, really needed in Samoa at the moment. So it's on the airline.
Tupa'i Saleh Mo'ava'i runs my Moana Seaside Lodge. He says Samoans usually travel for family commitments such as family fa'alavilavis, and they need greater options.
Samoa has a very unique market. Our people love to come home, and our people travel regardless. So when there's a holiday, we just hop on. But it's really affecting how our tourism industry develops, because of the high shares that Air New Zealand puts into trying to get into Samoa. It will eventually have a big impact on the demand for Samoa by bona fide tourists.
Tourism operator Tupai Saemoa Mvai, ending that report from the ABC's reporter in Samoa, Adele Froon. When it comes to Pacific politics, there's been no bolder and more controversial figure in recent years than Solomon Islands Prime Minister Manase Sogavare. He has been attracting plenty of global attention ever since signing Solomon Islands up to a security pact with China in 2022. His impact on international politics has been clear, and that's why Richard Naidu and his editorial team at Islands Business Magazine in Fiji have named the Solomons leader as their Pacific Person of the Year for 2023.
He really is a force of history, if you like, in terms of the overall context of where the region is placed at this particular moment in time. And he just cuts a figure that also cuts across so many of those elements. And he sits very squarely and firmly in that dimension. And it wasn't difficult at all for us to make that choice.
Now, tell us a bit about the selection process. How was this done? And was there certain criteria that Alan's business had to go through to get to that Person of the Year award?
Yeah, it's really looking at, you know, what sort of place a news figure or a public figure has in the Pacific. And there are times when there are achievements, as you put it, but then there are also times when, in the case of Sonovare, it's purely impact, you know, momentum, and just the sort of, as I've mentioned earlier, the force of history sort of element that doesn't happen too often, but when it does, it's very clear to recognize. And so those are some of the parameters we work through when looking at, you know, who the title should go to. And that sort of happens naturally towards the very end part of the year. And so it's really a discussion between the very experienced editorial team that we have, not just here in Fiji, but in terms of just the, you know, our contributors around the region as well. So draws from the insights of people who write, you know, regularly and quite incisively in terms of what's happening.
And that was Richard Naidu, the editor of Fiji-based Islands Business magazine. With all the talk about climate change, you might begin to think that low-lying islands in the Pacific are doomed. But that may not be the case, according to a recent study from the University of Auckland in New Zealand. Dr. Sebastian Steibel says common ideas about low-lying islands may not be correct or even helpful.
There's a lot of misconceptions circling around, or simplifications circling around these coral atolls. We see them as low-lying island landforms, and we sort of assume them as static islands, as static lands, and then we just add up the predicted numbers of sea level rise and come to the conclusion that these islands are going to inevitably drown. This is sort of the dominant narrative that we're seeing here, with catastrophic consequences, in my opinion, for how we look into conservation opportunities and place-based solution for local communities on these islands. But the relationship between sea level rise and these atoll islands is a bit more complex. So these atoll islands are not like a volcanic island, like the Hawaiian island, for example. These are volcanic islands, are basically inanimate rock that just sit there. But atolls, coral atolls, as the name already suggests, are made up entirely of biological material, of coral reef sediments, of skeletal material from reef organisms. And we can sort of think of the coral reef as the sediment factory that generates these sediments. And these sediments then get moved onto these islands and allow these islands to grow. And what we see from a lot of studies that have come out over the last years is that these islands, these atoll islands, they are actually capable of growing at pace with sea levels. So the rethinking that we're kind of proposing with this article is that these atolls, that introduces basically a new dimension. So these atolls can grow. And what we're asking right now is there anything that we can do as conservationists, as restoration ecologists, to improve this natural growing process of these islands?
If it's not actually sea level rise per se that is putting these atolls at risk, what is threatening the future of coral atolls in places like the Pacific?
No, so it's sea level rise and climate change is definitely a major impact and a major threat. This is not the argument. The argument is that they're not inevitably lost because they sort of have this superpower that they can, or that they are naturally growing. And on the one hand, the let's call them the global impacts of warming oceans, of rising sea temperatures, of ocean acidification, they are threatening the coral reefs and the sediment factory sort of that allows these islands to grow.
Dr. Sebastian Steibel from the University of Auckland, and he was speaking there with ABC's Marion Farr. And that's it from Pacific Review. I'm Evan Mosuka. Thank you for listening, and do join us again at the same time next week for more news and views from across the Pacific. Pacific Review was produced on the lands of the Boonwurrung and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation.